Hey, here we are at another podcast for Old School Guns, your place to get the straight info and discuss things like classic firearms, the gun culture, questions and answers, and just anything that crops up as a matter of interest to the community at large. Anyway, let's talk about the tumultuous times at the NRA. This has been on everybody's radar screen, and it's been there's all kinds of articles out there. NPR and all the traditional enemies of the NRA are kind of piling on. Here's basically how I see it. I've never been an Oliver North fan. He was basically kind of a shifty guy. I think he had some good motivations when he did a lot of his things, but the ends don't always justify the means. He got caught, he got punished, he got kicked out. He did get convicted, and that was all overturned, so he's clear. But I'm just not sure that he's the guy that was really a good person to be the president of the NRA. I'm just not sure. Within the community, I think it was not a problem. Outside the community and how they view us, I think the selection of Oliver North in 2018 created a perception problem. As far as the expenses and some of the other foolishness that's been going on, they clearly do need to get out there and reform some of this. I understand it costs money to travel, and if you're taking a guy like Wayne LaPierre, you can't always stick him in economy class. There's a couple different reasons for that. One of them is actually security. You know, there are enough kooks out there, if they recognize him, see him, something could happen. So he's kind of a guy who's kind of got to be in first class. He kind of gets on the airplane quickly, kind of gets off the airplane quickly. But a lot of times he's going to have to use charters, and charters are a lot safer. They're a lot more secure. That's why celebrities use them. That's why anybody who has the means uses a charter. They're a lot more convenient. They're a lot faster, and they're a lot more secure. You know, there's a reason that we have Air Force One, and we don't just sit there and put the president in a first class cabin. You know, there's just a reason we do that, and that reason is security. And really, a guy like Wayne LaPierre is the same way. So I don't really begrudge him the travel, and I know he's got to travel places. There's been a burgeoning international push for gun control, and so you do have to go to the gun valley in Italy and talk to those gun makers and make sure you have relationships with them. You've got to make sure that you've got relationships with perhaps similar NRA type organizations in different countries. Not a whole lot, but you got to do some. So I think some of that was just piling on. Do I think that at a certain point in time should stand aside and hand over the reins? Yes, I do. Yes, I do. And I don't know who the person is, but I think they need to kind of find them sooner rather than later. It's just the way organizations work. No one person is indispensable, and we have to keep going. The other thing I'd like to see is I'm really not happy with the NRA board and how it is elected. It seems like they send out 2 or 3 million ballots a year for the election, and I think they get back something like 150,000. So a very small group, about 10% of the people eligible to vote are actually voting, and they're returning these perennial people to power. What I do is, I'll be honest with you, when I get my ballot, the first thing I do is Google everybody, and anybody over the age of 80, I'm sorry, you don't get my vote. And if you're in your 70s, I kind of look at age there too. I think we need younger, we need some very, very vibrant people. The other thing is, I don't think somebody should be on the board simply because they're famous. They better be doing something. Just because you have name recognition, because you played professional sports, or you were in politics, or you were this, that, or the other thing, does not entitle you to a seat on the board. It just does not. So I think that definitely they have to start recruiting some younger, more vibrant people who can actually get out there and make the case. And I think that's one of the problems that we have, and one of the frustrations gun owners have. We have a whole list of things that need to be fixed, and we just wasted 2 years. We should have gotten the Protection of Hearing Act, which would take silencers, sound suppressors, off the NFA. We should have gotten that. Controlled the House. Excuse me. Controlled the House and the Senate and the presidency. We should have gotten that. And if we had to trade bump stocks to get it, well, maybe that's not a bad trade. I'm not a bump stock fan, so I think giving them up without getting something for it is definitely a problem. National whatever that word is, so you can carry your concealed weapons permit in another state, you have to basically get that. And we just, the door closed. I don't think the House will ever allow that. I don't know if that's something that can be done within an executive order. I'm not a real fan of executive orders, frankly, because they've been used against gun owners. George H.W. Bush, the phony conservative, a man who was just would say anything to get elected, but really turned out to be no friend of ours, enacted all those 89 import bans and that stupid section 922 that everybody has to abide by to make sure you got enough domestic-made parts on a gun. So it's a very convoluted thing, and frankly, I think if you look at a lot of the firearms out there, there's probably technical violations of that thing all over the place as to what constitutes a U.S.-made part, and can that be in the part count, and is it, what about an unmarked part? Nobody's really ever answered that. And on the good side, I don't know that they've ever prosecuted anyone over that. Certainly never heard of it, but it is an owner's thing. Needs to go away. Just go away. The 89 import ban, most of the firearms, like FNFALs and G3, HK91s, the civilian G3, a lot of those guns that were affected by that really aren't made anymore. So it really doesn't matter that much, but I'd like to see those things off the books. I'd like to see semi-automatic Uzis that could be imported and not just recreated from torched parts kits and things like this. So those kind of things need to go away. There's a whole litany of things that need to be fixed, and they need to get on it and get it fixed. That's what the NRA is paid to do by its members, and that's what it needs to do. There is a lot of good news out there. The good news is there's a lot of places where you could never concealed carry before, where you can, where they have to issue you a license if you're a law-abiding citizen. And there's places like the wonderful state of Kansas and a few other, and some other states, where you get constitutional carry. So you can carry your pistol without a permit as long as you're a law-abiding citizen. Those are all good things, and that's what the NRA needs to build on. But they need to go after some of these other things. It's only a matter of time before we get a Democrat in, whether it's 2020 or 2024 or 2028, and the pendulum swings back. And the more progress we can make while we have gun-friendly people in office, then it's going to be harder for them to push that back. And if they do, it's not going to push the pendulum way over to the other side like we were with the 94 assault weapons ban and some of that other garbage legislation that's come out of Congress. And, you know, Congress has basically become a freak show, a theater of the absurd, which, you know, people acting like goofballs. It's become an identity politic Congress of fools. When you have somebody who, they exert executive privilege, so the Attorney General does not show up to testify, okay, you can argue that case back and forth, whatever the merits are of that. What you don't do is show up with a bucket of fried chicken like one of those idiots did, and then, you know, flash it around for the cameras, insinuating the Attorney General's a chicken, and I'm eating chicken. And I mean, that's goofy. That's not what we elect. Even a lawmaker you disagree with, you expect them to have a little higher standard of behavior. And the Three Stooges, I call them, this Omar, Tlaib, and Ocasio-Cortez, clearly unqualified to be lawmakers. The things they say, the positions they take, it's not about do I agree with them or disagree with them. It's that they fundamentally don't understand anything. Ocasio-Cortez apparently studied economics at Boston College and doesn't know the first thing about it. Tlaib and Omar, dangerously anti-Semitic, very, very sketchy ties to what I consider some extreme identity politics. They're going to have to be watched, because that is not what we're looking for in a national body of people who are supposed to debate points and make logical laws. Some of the other people out there, this guy Sawwell, who has been christened by me as Sewage Well, you know, making just open threats against law-abiding gun owners. A terroristic law-abiding threat. I mean, when you threaten to nuke gun owners, nuke? Really? The other thing that he's also said is, well, if they don't go along with these new laws I'm going to make, we're just going to throw them all in jail. And without even saying, without even realizing that the new laws he's proposing are unconstitutional by any, an eighth grade civics student can make a constitutional judgment on the types of things he's proposing and their constitutionality, which they're not constitutional. So a lot of real fools out there making a lot of threats have not seen this kind of activity since late 1960s. And we all, anybody who lived through that, I lived through it as a kid, and man, it was a mess. You had people with making bombs, you had people doing all kinds of crazy things. And I think that the crazy lunatic left fringe wants to return to some of that. You know, even in 2008, their slogan was "Recreate 68." I lived through 68, and there's no way we ever want to recreate that. I think that we have to realize that the fringe politic is something that really needs to be marginalized, pushed off to the side, and people of goodwill need to come together and make laws. And right now we don't have that. We just have representative of these bizarre fringes, and unfortunately they're in Congress and they're making fools out of themselves. Hopefully the 2020 election will rectify that. I'm hoping that through some good graces and some common sense and some clarity, that people actually restore that to the Republicans, to good-willed Republicans, because there's some deep stater and establishment guys who need to go to read Mitt Romney into that. And I think we absolutely have to get back to good governance as opposed to shrieking, issue-driven, poll-driven lunatic fringe positions. So that's where I am with that, and that's kind of where I am on the 2A and also the gun culture vis-a-vis the NRA. NRA is, they're out there. They're strong. They're great. The second vice president of the NRA, outstanding guy, and I hope we hear a lot of him from the future. His name is Willis Lee. He is retired U.S. Army lieutenant colonel, great guy, combat veteran. Really energetic, really smart, and you can look him up on Facebook. You can also look him up on the web. He is a good man. He's the kind of guy we need in there fighting for us, and he's also the kind of guy who can whip the organization into shape, get some accountability, clean up the messes and the slack that's in there with the spending and all the rest of that, and get it straight. So anyway, that's the view of that. Wanted to talk a little bit about gun media today. Gun media, you know, is there anything sadder than going into the supermarket or going into the bookstore or going into whatever store you go into? And to me, I always go to where the gun magazines are. I've done it all my life. I've literally have done it all my life. From the time I was about 9, 10 years old and until now. And, you know, I'm amazed at one thing, that there are plenty of gun magazines still out there. A lot of them have gone by the boards. And in the internet age, I think that's going to be the trend. But, you know, they're just not the quality they used to be. They don't have the personality writers. They don't even have the interesting, the articles that we see coming out of these, in these gun magazines are, what's the latest and greatest AR? Well, latest and greatest Wonder 9. Used to be latest and greatest custom 1911. Now it's kind of customized Wonder 9 or little goof, whatever AR thing they can come up with where they can make it smaller and lighter and all the rest of it. We don't really have a lot of the great opinion like we used to. And we also see some of the gun companies. Auto Ordnance, who I really like, Car Arms Auto Ordnance, they make some great guns. They make some outstanding guns. They've kind of gone into this kind of weird thing of making these kind of laser engraved commemoratives, you know, the D-Day commemorative. I kind of look on it, and it's like looking at any of those made for mass consumption commemoratives. You look at it and you go, man, that's really cool, that's really nice. Then you think, but I would never buy that. I mean, it's, you know, $2,000 or whatever they sell them for. And it's basically kind of this cheesy engraving on there, even though a lot of it is very cool, you know. So it would be very cool to have a gun that kind of memorializes the Rangers at Point du Hoc, you know, and says Rangers lead the way and all this. That would be a lot of fun, but it's not something that's practical or useful. So that's out there, and they also have done the same thing with their 1911 line, which I think is one of the great undiscovered bargains out there, is the Auto Ordnance 1911. Looks just like a government model. It is a Series 80, basically, inside. But that's not really a problem. You can't detect that from the outside of the gun. And it really does shoot and perform well, just like a GI-45. I put it next to a Remington Rand World War II 1944 production GI-45. And it's pretty much looks just about like it. You know, you could easily mistake them at 10 feet, and you couldn't tell which one was which. I mean, they are very, very nice guns. So you're looking for a GI-45, Car Arms is really a way to go. They are not a sponsor. I have no sponsors. So anybody I endorse is based on my own experience and my own beliefs. So let's go and look at some questions here, because that is the other part of our show, is answering questions that have been submitted to us, submitted to me. And I kind of look at these things ahead of time, but I don't study them or read them. I kind of know what they are, but I don't really think much about them, because I don't want to sound real rehearsed and like, here is the question, here is the answer. No, I kind of like to see where these things can take me. And you know, there have been some really interesting ones. Here's one: what do you think about Hudson Arms closing? Hudson Arms made, you know, I think it's just like any other gun company I've seen come and go. There's usually a big splash, there's usually some really good prototypes, and then they have some quality control problems or delivery problems. And you're talking to a guy who owns one of the original AMT hardballers, which I got a great one and I love it, but I realized they also put out some dogs that people hated. And as good as mine is, I realize that there's some that didn't do it. It's like a great restaurant. You know, you can learn how to cook a great steak, but if you don't keep up the quality control and consistency, not everyone's going to get that great steak, and some people are going to leave there very disappointed. And that's usually what these small startup gun companies do. I mean, the classic was Dornaus and Dixon with the Bren 10, which was a whole soup sandwich in and of its own. But the reason Hudson had a problem was, if there were two guns that I would never introduce to the current gun market, one would be a 9mm of any kind, because frankly there's a whole bunch of choices out there and all the big players are in it, and all the big players have got years of R&D into these guns, so they're making them, they're reasonably accurate, very dependable, very reliable. They're really selling reliability and durability and kind of the service accuracy, which is fine. That's what it is. You can put adjustable sights on it. You can do like Walther, come out with a match version. But I would never bring out a $1,200 or $1,300, $1,000+ 9mm pistol, because there are so many great, you can buy great 9mm pistols for $500 all day long. I was just looking at a HK VP9, $529 somewhere. You know, yeah, the MSRP is $625 or $650 or something. But the fact of the matter is, you can buy them all day long for $525. Can probably find good deals on Glocks, and you can find good deals on Smith & Wesson M&Ps. And there's the list goes on. Walther makes, you know, the Walther M2s, you know. They have all these pistols. And they're all functionally, they're not identical, but they're very similar. So it's just a question of what you like versus what you don't like. I would never enter that market. I would never enter that market if I were trying to do that, especially with a design that, like all gun designs, probably is going to take some refinement. So why would you do that? It's just a bad place to go. The next gun I would never introduce would be a 22 long rifle version of anything. And the reason I say that is because, you know, there are some great, you can get M4s, you can get, I have the STG-44. I got that as a Christmas present. And it's a lot of fun. It's fun to shoot. A little disappointing, it just kind of goes poof, poof, as a 22 does, instead of, because when you feel it, it feels like a genuine military rifle, and you would expect more recoil. But it's a fun gun to shoot, and a great gun to basically plink with, and it's a lot of fun. However, I would never introduce that because, shoot, as soon as you buy them, something happens, and people panic buy the ammo, like after Sandy Hook, and you can't find any 22 long rifle ammo. Or if you do, it's exorbitantly priced. You know, guys who bought a brick for $10 and stored it away for 2 years were selling them at gun shows for $50, you know, the profiteering. So, and you can't reload for it. You're stuck. You buy, if you want to shoot it, you buy the factory ammo. You're kind of stuck into that. Plus, a 22 is never, it's never really going to appreciate in value, especially if it's a 22 Uzi or 22 MP5 or 22 STG or 22 M4. It's never really going to appreciate in value, but they're a lot of fun. They don't really have to. The other thing is, it's just never going to be a widely desirable gun. It's not the real thing. It's a clone. It's a kind of a low-powered copy. And, you know, to be very blunt, it doesn't have all the details that the full-caliber gun has. It's just not. They're meant to hit a price point. They're meant to... They look good, and they do a great job, but they... You know, they're not exactly the same thing. So, those are the two guns I would never bring out. And Hudson brought out a 9mm, and they got slammed. They probably would have done better in the United States. If you want to bring out a gun, you need to bring it out in 45 ACP. I hate to say it, but if you bring it out in 45 ACP, you will probably be successful, because that's a caliber Americans like. People like it. And you can bring out a 9mm version later once you get a good reputation, if everything kind of falls in the line. People like 45. I still wouldn't do it, because I think the pistol market is crowded. I think there are great designs out there, and why would you? Part of the proof of that is... You go there and you find EAA and some of these other companies, you know, European companies. Well, there's the Turkish copy of the Beretta 92. You know, I mean, there's so many good designs out there that actually, rather than bringing a new design to the market, they're just copying something else. There's also copies of what look like the VP9, what looks like a Glock, very Glock-like type pistols. So, you know, you have to be very... You're going to enter the market, you really have to have something else, something different. If you're going to enter the rifle market, the first question you have to ask is your rifle even going to be better than the ARs that are out there? The ARs rule the world right now. They've knocked the AK... In the U.S. market, they've knocked the AK off the pedestal. It used to be... Remember, there was the old AK versus AR argument. You never hear that anymore. The AR has taken over. It's completely taken over. It's a lot more modular. It's a lot more. You can gunsmith it yourself if you want to. You can buy a lower, put the parts in yourself. Buy the upper you want for whatever purpose you need it for, and you're off to the races. The only reason to buy an AK is simply because A, you like them, and there's a certain nostalgia with them. And they are a great design. I'm not saying anything against them, but you're going to pay. When you look at prices, it's almost 40 to 50% more for an AK as opposed to a similar AR. Why would you? Same thing with the any of the European rifles now, the SIGs and a few of these others. The reason they don't even bother to try to make them in semi-automatic and market them over here is the AR, they can't compete on the price point. Same thing, a Mini 14. Great gun for many years, but it just can't compete. As a matter of fact, that brings us to another question. Could the Mini 14 have been developed into a viable military rifle which could compete with the M16 series? The answer is, had it come out in the late 1950s, there might have been a window which it could have flourished in. However, I think that was a very tight window, and they obviously didn't hit it. The Mini didn't come out until years later, early 70s. By then, the M16A1 had its bugs worked out. It was combat experience in Southeast Asia, and it was not going. The Mini 14 was not going to displace it. Mini 14 did have a really good career in law enforcement. Their agencies adopted it. They've since probably gotten rid of them. Prison guards and a few things, and a lot of prison guards replaced Winchester 1907s, which by the 1970s were pretty antiquated design. They replaced those with Mini 14s and got a tremendous capability boost. I think DOE used Mini 14s for a while, but anybody who used them is basically gone. Anybody who used them has replaced them. It's just that simple. Because you could the Mini 14, you go in and even on the retail market, you can see it costs more. It costs $200 to $300 more for a rifle that does the same thing but not as well. I mean, and go buy Mini 14 magazines. I mean, 30-round magazine, $45. I can go buy GI magazines, and sometimes you can find them at flea markets and any place else. GI M16 magazines, you can find those for $10. You can buy P mags at $12.95. You know, so it's just not—it's not competing on any level. Plus, it's an older design, a design which does not lend itself to modernization, or modern weapon handling. The safety is inside the trigger guard, which, you know, the finger off the trigger, it's the grand style safety is considered passe, and it's considered something that modern trainers really don't want to deal with, really don't want to have anything to do with that. It's also basically an exposed action. Crud can get in there. And it's the 2-lug action versus an 8-lug locking action. So the Mini just doesn't compete. What it was really designed to be, and what it really excels at, is being a replacement for the 30-30, that all-around gun. It's got more capability, more capacity, it's powerful, and you can definitely use it to on a ranch or in a rural environment. It's definitely gives you increased capability over something like a Winchester 30-30, but it's really never going to displace the AR. That's just the way it goes. All right, let's see. Surplus pistols for self-defense, home defense, concealed carry. I guess that's saying, are they actually viable for those things? The answer is yes, with limitations. It used to be a price point thing, especially when, you know, you could get surplus pistols for less than $100 or right around the $100 mark. That was basically cost effective, and you could get it, and you could buy magazines cheap. Now, they're all the designs are now dated for the state of the art. They're not usually high capacity. They're not usually striker fired. I can't think of any that are. So it's usually DASA or just single action. So you do have basically a degradation in capability. Now, most people, that doesn't really matter very much, but it is there. The other thing is the magazines and spare parts can now be very expensive, if not impossible to find. But for home defense, hey, a gun you're not really going to be shooting a lot. A surplus pistol is very nice because if it functions, it's good. It's passed a lot of military testing. It's kind of a proven design. And it's going to be something that you can definitely count on. And it has some embedded quality that's in there that something like a High Point just isn't going to have. And the price points are going to be actually pretty similar. So going with a Star BM, which is selling for sub $200 right now, is going to be a better purchase than perhaps the High Point pistol, which looks like a big water pistol. And you know, that in my book, I would go with the Star BM. It's a known quantity military surplus pistol. As long as it's in good shape and functions, and you can take it out a couple times a year, practice with it, it should defend your home adequately. Concealed carry, a lot of them were not designed for concealed carry, and a lot of them are steel frame, so they're going to be heavier. Again, it's possible, but probably not. You're probably better off getting a comparable, and there's so many. Even Smith & Wesson Shield is $250, pardon me, on sale in places. You know, that's probably a better option. Self-defense, yeah, it depends what you mean by self-defense. I think if you're out just kind of woods bumming and things like that, they're definitely good to have and as good as they ever were. So they usually are chambered. I would stay away from some of the smaller or weirder calibers, but 9x18, 9x19, and certainly 45 caliber, you're not losing anything to anybody. I think military surplus is really kind of drying up. What you're seeing now is police surplus, and especially 40 caliber, as the police departments get rid of 40 caliber and kind of transition back to 9mm with improved ammunition. I think the money's on, hey, these 40 caliber guns are really good, and although ammunition is more expensive than 9mm, these things are pretty cost effective, and you can get I think for $300 price range, you can get some nice used 40 caliber, and that's probably the direction I would go if I were looking for home defense, self-defense gun. But you're going to find service autos, service style, police style, you know, duty guns are going to be a little big for concealed carry, but it's possible. All right. What are the best magazines for AR-type rifles in 5.56? Yeah, there was some BS put out on this. I think it was the InRange guys or somebody. Basically said, you know, P mags and went through this litany and you know, GI mags are at the bottom. That's basically hogwash. They're all good magazines. I've got magazines of various vintages, various manufacturers. Some I actually picked up in the field. You know, I've been sitting out there for 6 months. And you take them, you clean them up, and as long as they're not dented, as long as the spring is good, you're doing pretty well. I know guys get all upset about anti-tilt followers and all these kind of things, but I will tell you, I've never really had a problem with a undamaged GI magazine. And I've got some that have got metal followers, some of these Vietnam-era ones that were kind of used in back in the 70s and 80s. When you qualified with an M16, you went and zeroed first, and then you would fire the qualification on the pop-up target range. And to zero the gun, they would usually put 3 rounds in 20-round magazines, and that's how they could segregate. And that way you didn't get a 30-round magazine to zero and a 3-round magazine to qualify. They kind of kept them separate that way. At a certain point, they got rid of all the 20s, and you could find them. The people were throwing them away, and they were just there for the taking. And I picked up probably a dozen or more of those, and they still work fine. And they're very, very convenient magazines to use, because when you're shooting off a bench or doing a zeroing with the gun on a rest or whatever, they don't stick down, the gun doesn't monopod on them, they don't snag on a lot of things. So they're really good magazines, and you see kind of a renaissance in 20-round magazines. Almost all the manufacturers kind of offer a 20-round magazine for, I think, probably precisely that reason. But the answer is, what is the best magazine for an AR-type rifle in 5.56? The magazine that is undamaged, maintained, and routinely tested. That's the best magazine. Doesn't matter the manufacturer. It matters how it performs, and it matters if it's being taken care of. That's what matters. What are your deal breakers in a modern military rifle? I would say there's very few deal breakers. As I'm thinking of modern military rifles, the one that jumps out at me is I do not like military rifles that do not have a bolt hold open. That includes like the AK and G3. I understand why they don't, because we're thinking of squad level tactics and one guy running out of ammo and having a delayed reload because he looks at a target, he clicks, and then he realizes he's empty, he takes his magazine out, reloads, recharges the weapon. That delay, as opposed to the AR guy who knows when he's fired that last round, the bolt's at the rear, he just swipes the old magazine out, puts a new one in, probably three times faster. But they were thinking that they were going to have massed infantry, that it was essentially squad-level tactics. So if you ran out, the guys next to you probably weren't running out, and they were going to engage. And it made the weapon a lot simpler, and it wasn't considered a big deal to the Warsaw Pact. I think the Germans were probably the same way. Made the weapon simpler, and they were all about simplifying the G3 and making it as durable and reliable as they could. But to me as an individual, those are deal breakers. I can't think of a worse feeling than, and it's always, you almost always have the perfect trigger release and everything else, and then you hear that sickening click, you know. I can only imagine that in combat or in a stress situation that would be very, very bad, and you'd be in a very compromised position as an individual. So that's why those are deal breakers to me. Here's another one. Is 5.5 by 39 better than 7.62 by 39 for combat use? And the answer is yes and no. Yes, if you like the high velocity flat shooting cartridge. No, if you're looking at just really combat ranges, availability, and just general use. I think 5.45 by 39 is an outstanding cartridge. I think it's great. I think it's one of the best things that the Russians ever came up with. I think it's absolutely first rate. But I just don't think that it's that much better than the 7.62 by 39. That it was not a game changer, was not a world changer. It was simply different, a little bit better. But was it better enough? Well, most countries didn't change. So Russia did in the Soviet Union and then post-Soviet time. They changed, but a lot of countries have not. And they've either stayed with it or they've abandoned it for something else, like 5.56. Are revolvers dead for military, law enforcement, and sporting? Sporting, no. Revolvers are still an outstanding choice. They're powerful. They're reliable. They usually have very good sighting systems, excellent trigger pulls. They, for sporting use, whether it's target shooting or in the field, game shooting, they're first rate. They're really good. They're excellent for defense, excellent for a lot of things. And that's it. Law enforcement, they're basically been replaced as duty weapons. I think there's still some around as backups. And they're still a really good option for backup. They have a reliability that's there. You know, you have six shots in a small revolver as a backup gun or an off-duty gun. That's a really good, very reliable kind of package that can get you out of trouble. Same thing it does for a civilian who's a carrier. It's very, very good, and it does exactly what it's intended to do. For military, they've been dead since World War II. I mean, they were used in World War II simply because there wasn't anything else. The British used scads of revolvers, even though they were trying to use the Browning high power as much as they could. U.S. used revolvers simply because we had them left over from World War I and before. And the last military revolvers in U.S. service were probably the 70s and 80s. And that was a Smith & Wesson M15, which was the Model 15 combat masterpiece the Air Force Air Police used. Excellent, excellent revolver. There's no question about that. I also saw 38 special revolvers. They were actually Victory model Smith & Wessons from World War II that were in a couple of Army arms rooms in the 1980s. So I'm sure those are long gone, but yeah, they were around. I mean, there's always that need for a good, reliable, reasonably powerful gun. And a revolver fits that very, very well. It fits that very, very well. But you'll never see another military revolver. You just won't. I'm sure there are some places on the planet where old Webleys, 38 caliber Webleys from World War II are being used in old Commonwealth countries, perhaps in Africa, some places. There's some second or third auxiliary types of forces using those, but you'll never see another one come out. It's kind of a shame, really, because they were very nice guns. Well, that about does it, and I hope that you enjoy the podcast. I hope you enjoy the commentary, and if you want, you can send me some comments, and we will put up an address for you, and you will be able to do that. However, you know, my deal is although I'm on Facebook, I'm not really a Facebook fan, so I'm not going to start a page where every idiot can go ahead and make imbecilic remarks. You don't agree with me? Hey, I'm sorry. If everybody in the room is thinking the way you do, you need to find another room. And that's what this is. This is the other room. And anyway, until next time, we'll see you around.